Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show on a flash episode. That's right, a surprise episode on this Monday. We're going to talk about antitrust, monopolies, Amazon and Google, and what's the conservative approach to monopolies. We're going to take a couple of your questions. This is Charlie Kirk, Charlie Kirk Show. Let's get right into it. This episode of the Charlie Kirk Show is brought to you by ExpressVPN. I use ExpressVPN all the time on all my devices, on my phone, on my tablet, and on my computer. Admit it, you think that cybercrime is something that happens to other people. You might not think it's your data that they're going to hack, that they're going to get in, but I'm telling you right now, cyber warfare is something that is happening all the time. Cyber criminals are on the loose. Here's what ExpressVPN does. If you don't know what a VPN is, essentially, it's a private network that is set up on any of your devices. So it protects your data, it protects your IP address, it encrypts all your behavior, and ExpressVPN is critical. So think of it, would you have a house without a lock on it? Would you have a car without a lock on it? ExpressVPN is a lock on your phone to make sure that cyber criminals cannot get into your data and see what you are doing. It's especially important if you use public Wi-Fi, whether on your college campus or on an airplane. If you're using a lot of other people's Wi-Fi in that Starbucks, you need ExpressVPN. You might as well just have an open door into your computer, an open door into your phone, if you want other people to get into your data and monitor what you are doing. That's why I use ExpressVPN. It's less than $7 a month. Using our promo code today, it's the sponsor of our show today at Charlie Kirk Show, ExpressVPN. You can go to expressvpn.com/Charlie. That's expressvpn.com/Charlie for 3 months free and a 1 year package. I use it. You got to use it to protect your data. Don't let other people in on your phone or your computer. You will not be sorry. That's expressvpn.com/Charlie. So I want to thank everyone just for listening to our show and supporting our program here. Give us those 5 stars. Hit subscribe at the Charlie Kirk Show. We're just so thankful for our loyal listeners. And we're happy today just to have another flash episode. As you know, you can count on the Charlie Kirk Show every Wednesday. But we felt moved and compelled to add another episode this week. It did so well last week. So I just want to dive right into it. I'm looking right now at the Drudge Report, at the recording of this program, and I see at the top, Amazon prepares for antitrust action. And on kind of some of the sublinks, it shows Google also preparing, and it says, should Google be worried about antitrust action? So for those of you that don't know, what exactly does antitrust mean? Well, this goes all the way back to 1890 with the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act that was passed by then-President Benjamin Harrison. Benjamin Harrison passed the 1890s Sherman Antitrust Act, which actually got popularized by President Theodore Roosevelt when in 1902 he urged the Department of Justice to use the Sherman Antitrust Act to dismantle the Northern Securities Corporation, which of course got appealed all the way up to the United States Supreme Court in March in 1904, which ruled 5-4 actually that the Northern Securities Corporation violated the Sherman Antitrust Act. This is the first example of major trust busting because they called Theodore Roosevelt the trust buster in chief, if you will. Now, there's some stuff that Teddy Roosevelt did that I really agreed with, such as protections of the environment. And, you know, as an Eagle Scout and as a Boy Scout, I think we should have clean air and clean water. And I believe there is a place for government in ensuring that, because all individuals have to breathe the air and breathe water. So you can't have any sort of protection of the individual if you have no such environmental protections. However, I think the current, you know, Environmental Protection Agency, or as I call it, the Employment Prevention Agency, the other way to say the EPA, actually gets in the way of entrepreneurship and individual liberties. There are examples of how environmentalism can go too far, where environmentalism can become anti-business. And I think we as conservatives should wear the mantle as being proud defenders of environmentalism, but also mixing that with protecting the individual and having a pro-entrepreneurial, pro-business focus, because what's in the word conservative? Well, to conserve and look at the gifts that God gave us in the mountains and the rivers and the lakes. And America has been given such the most beautiful natural resources, some of those unbelievable national parks and just beauty and majesty in our country. And I think we have an obligation to protect them. And so Theodore Roosevelt, some would call him a progressive, some would call him a populist. He was really the most famous trust buster. He was the most famous person in American history to use the Sherman Antitrust Act. And so you go all the way back to that decision in 1904, there's been many times the Sherman Antitrust Act has been used over the last 110 years, 115 years, if you go all the way back to 1904. The Sherman Antitrust Act has been used in one way or the other under the Department of Justice from even going after Microsoft in the 1990s when Microsoft became too big, and many other examples. And so we get to today. The idea is that is really being posed is Amazon too powerful? Is Google too powerful? And now I'm going to be quite honest with all of you. It's a difficult question for me to answer because immediately I want to go where Milton Friedman went. Milton Friedman would go in the direction of almost all monopolies are created because of government handouts, government favors, and insider access. And so let's use the example of Boeing. Boeing is not having a good couple months. I'll tell you, Boeing has had a tough couple of months, and the New York Times actually did some very good reporting. That's right, Charlie Kirk right here on the Charlie Kirk Show complimenting the New York Times. They did some phenomenal reporting over the weekend, actually showing how Boeing deceived and even lied at times about the failures in the 737 MAX, which is horrible when you think about it. But Boeing essentially has a pseudo-monopoly because of government. I talked about this on the Steve Hilton Show. I love Steve Hilton on Fox News about last week, where I said, what if we actually try to decentralize the airline manufacturing component of our economy, not just have only Boeing be able to make transcontinental airplanes. There's only two companies in the world. There's only two companies in the world that can make those kind of airplanes with that kind of demand on production, if you will. And that's Airbus, which is out of France, and Boeing, which is headquartered in Chicago, Illinois, but really their main place of operation, their main area is in Seattle, Washington. So they kind of have stations in both, if you will. But Boeing spends a ton of money on lobbying and public affairs, amazing amounts of money. And because of that, they get these insider government crony contracts where they're more focused on protecting those contracts than they are in research and development. And so they have a monopoly, and that's a monopoly that has been created because of government. So with that, I do agree with Milton Friedman. I do agree that government, large in part, is the biggest creator of monopolies. Why is that? Well, because government is the biggest monopoly. Government has a monopoly on power and has a monopoly on force. Government has a monopoly on the ability to lock us up and has a monopoly on essentially the police mechanism of a society. So we have to be very, very careful how and when we use government. Now, so what the Sherman Antitrust Act does is it allows the Department of Justice, which is government, to go after private corporations when they do actually hit that monopolistic threshold. And there's a lot of debate in the legal community of, well, when is actually something become a monopoly and what actually constitutes a monopoly. And so some would say, well, when you hit 30%, and other lawyers would say when you hit 50% market share, that's what I'm talking about, market share. So for example, ExxonMobil, let's use ExxonMobil, you know, those evil fossil fuel companies. And I actually appreciate the work that ExxonMobil does. And they're innovating really quickly, by the way. ExxonMobil just came out with some amazing new technology to extract CO2 from some of the power plants and some of the refineries. Let me correct myself, some of the refineries that they have, which is amazing technology, and good on ExxonMobil at being ahead of the curve. Isn't it amazing what the free market will do? Isn't it amazing how the free market a lot of times will solve a lot of these issues without government regulation? And so ExxonMobil, a company that gets demonized continually in Washington, D.C., has 5% market share. That's right, only 5% market share in oil, fossil fuel extraction, and upstream type development in the fossil fuel industry. 5% market share. You'd be amazed to hear that. They're actually one of the most valuable companies in the world. And so the question, you got to beg the question, what about Google? And what about Amazon? What percentage of market share do they have? Now, Google does a lot of different things. Google does email. Google is putting a new fiber network in. Google has their Android operating system. But the backbone of Google, I think we would all agree, is their search engine. The secret sauce of Google that keeps them going is their ability to capture data through Google Chrome, Google Email, and of course that little box that has now become one of the most used verbs in our vernacular is just Google it. Hey, why don't you look it up on just Google it? Just Google it. How many times do you say that a week? I know I say it almost daily. And I try not to. I try not to use it. I say, why don't we search bar it? There's other search engines. Google has, get this, a 92% market share in the search engine space. 92%. Yahoo, the second on that list, 2.67%. Bing, which is owned by Microsoft, 2.3%. That might be a monopoly, folks. Could you imagine if ExxonMobil had 92%? Could you imagine if ExxonMobil had 70%? Could you imagine if ExxonMobil had 40%? Could you imagine if ExxonMobil had 20% market share? ExxonMobil has 5%, and they're still demonized, and they're still said to be too big and too powerful. And so there's two kind of lessons from that. First of all, the double standard of the left is they constantly criticize ExxonMobil for being too big and too powerful when in reality they only have 5% market share. And the other kind of lesson is Google can still be a very valuable functioning company and have less than 92%. Now look, when you have that big of a market share and you have that kind of dominance over the search engine space, it's not just having 92% market share of making movies, which is really important. Search engines is actually where a lot of people form public opinion. It's where a lot of people find information that dictates behavior. So one could make the argument, and I would, that Google has 92% control of people. And some would make the argument, such as the great Tucker Carlson, it's hard to disagree with this, that Google in a lot of different ways is more powerful than the federal government in certain aspects. For example, if Google wants to tilt an election, they can. If Google all of a sudden wants all negative articles to come about Donald Trump, what's preventing them? If Google wants all positive things about Kamala Harris to come up, what's preventing them? If Google, and there's evidence that this happened, and this was unearthed in many secret tapes and in many videos that have come out since the midterm elections and since the 2016 election, where Google executives were actually apologizing to their employees, implying that they could have done more. So I want you to think about this, that the executives at Google were apologizing and somber that Donald Trump won the election. They have 92% of all search engine results. That means they have 92% control over the behavior and over the intellectual direction of everyone in America. That's really, really, really concerning and really scary. And if Google was predominantly conservative, if Google was like the owners of Chick-fil-A, let's play this thought exercise. If the Cathy family, which owns Chick-fil-A, owned Google, do you think the left would allow Google to have 92% of the market share? Do you think the tolerant left would allow Google, which would be owned by Bible-believing Christian conservatives, have 92% of search engine results? They would have riots in the streets. They would be screaming. They wouldn't allow that to happen for a second. Well, the shoe is actually on the other foot, because almost everybody that works at Google is a committed leftist. And you look at that, the guy that worked at Google a year and a half ago, who just wrote a memo. Great guy. I'll get his name in a second. Great guy. He wrote a memo just challenging the idea that men and women are exactly the same in everything that they do. That men and women are exactly the same in all things. Got fired for just sending around a memo that was a contrarian viewpoint at Google. Google search also showed Nazism as a California GOP ideology. Think about that. That Google used, that they described the California GOP ideology as Nazism. Of course, they just said that's a mistake. How many mistakes do these people just make? Of course, they're not mistakes. They are not regretful that they did it. They're regretful that they got caught. I want to say that again. Google is not regretful that they did these things. They're regretful that they got caught. James Damore is his name, or Damore. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it. James Damore is the name of the employee at Google that wrote this very non-controversial memo. You can read the memo. Got fired, currently suing Google. And lest we not forget, my friends at Prager University, done many good videos at Prager University. Love them over there. Dennis Prager is one of the heroes of the conservative movement. Have had their videos delisted. Have had their videos delisted on YouTube and demonetized and restricted, put on the restricted list, because they consider them to be hateful content. One of my videos that I did for Prager University in conjunction with Turning Point USA actually got on the restricted list at Google. So the question is, should a company have that much power? So let's transition to Amazon for a second. Amazon is also very powerful. They're not 92% powerful, but Amazon controls 47% of all online retail sales in America. Now, did you know that Amazon is actually on the verge of signing a $100 billion, that's right, a $100 billion contract, $10 billion a year, called the JEDI contract, J-E-D-I, J-E-D-I, which is an acronym essentially standing for a defense initiative. And essentially, so just so you know, a little background on Amazon that you might not know, Amazon's most profitable vertical in their company. They do a lot of different things. Amazon owns Whole Foods. Amazon is in the content creation space trying to go against Netflix. Amazon has Amazon Prime, which essentially is their delivery service. They have online retail sales. But the only profitable vertical in all of the Amazon family of different initiatives is Amazon Web Services, AWS. You might have seen a lot of advertisement with them recently. They've been doing a huge push. Essentially, it's a cloud service. Now, believe it or not, Netflix, which is a competitor to Amazon in the content creation space, actually uses Amazon Web Services. Go figure. AWS, because it really is a good program. Amazon, Bezos, Jeff Bezos, you got to give him credit. He invested early and often in the cloud computing space and data storage space. So essentially, to go back, the federal government is about to award Amazon with a $100 billion contract, $10 billion over 10 years, mostly to do the data storage and the cloud service for the Department of Defense, for the Pentagon, for the CIA. And hopefully, President Trump, God willing, will prevent this from happening. It is the ultimate crony capitalist handout. Why should the world's richest man and one of the largest, most valuable companies in the world have a contract of that size and that enormity? First of all, it's not good for security. Second of all, decentralize it. Don't create another Boeing. What if Amazon gets hacked? What if Amazon gets infiltrated by the Chinese, which is not unrealistic? What if Amazon gets corrupted? Decentralization allows competition, and decentralization allows the best ideas to rise to the top. So Amazon's on the verge of signing this huge contract. So this is the question, and this is a question that we as conservatives, if you're listening to this program and you're a conservative, we have to wrestle with. Because we as free marketeers, and I am a free marketeer, I'm a follower of Milton Friedman. I am a disciple of Thomas Sowell. I'm a committed Hayekian. I believe that free markets and free people are the most moral, it's the most moral, proven, and effective economic system ever discovered. Those lifted more people out of poverty than any other economic system ever. That the individual is paramount to a free society. I believe all those things. I believe them to my core. But I look at Google, which also, by the way, lest us not forget that Google takes billions of dollars from the Chinese government to self-censor their citizens. So Google, that pretends to be this, you know, really righteous company, they're also allowing the Chinese government to do evil things to their own citizens, evil things to the Muslims in China. Lest us not forget that. So look at these two companies, Google and Amazon. Boy, sure seems like they're monopolies, doesn't it? Now, here's a really important thing. It's actually, I do want to mention this too, that Google's own motto is don't be evil, or do no evil, I actually think is don't cross the creepy line is what they call, something like that. Let us not cross the creepy line is one of the things that their CEO has always said, which is just an amazing thing. I mean, I think they're well past the creepy line and their capacity and the power that they have. So you have Google and you have Amazon. Google with 92% of all search results. So let's just not call it search results. Let's say they have 92% potential control of human beings. So for example, if I were to Google Italian restaurants in Miami, Florida, Google could decide not to list the restaurants owned by conservatives just because they want to punish conservative and Trump supporters. Now that might seem like an extreme example, but you look at this pattern of behavior, nothing is stopping them. So we as conservatives also believe in something else, which is in the rule of law. And most important, the equal application of the rule of law. So someone who is really rich and powerful like Google or another entity like Amazon that is really rich and powerful should not be able to skirt the law. I want to correct something I said earlier. Google's phrase used to be don't be evil when it became Alphabet, which is the holding company of Google. If you actually try to buy Google stock, it's under Alphabet. In 2015, they changed it to do the right thing. Well, that's interesting how they change it from a negative to a positive. Anyway, we also believe in the equal application of the rule of law. And so whether we like the law or not is sort of irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Now, it's not irrelevant in the terms of whether or not we should pass new laws. So you might think that there should be no monopoly controls whatsoever. You might be a fierce libertarian, kind of a Rothbardian disciple, if you will. Murray Rothbard, great thinker. I agree with him on a couple things. I think he has some really good observations on our monetary system. I really enjoy reading him. Don't agree on everything, but that's okay. You might be there. But you should also agree with the equal application of the law. So there is the law, the Sherman Antitrust Act, that was passed in 1890. And of course, really made popular by the trust buster himself, President Theodore Roosevelt. And that Sherman Antitrust Act would assuredly be used against ExxonMobil if they got 20 or 30% market share or 40% market share. But now Google's sitting there with 92% market share and Amazon with 47% market share in their respective verticals of what they're most known about. Doesn't that warrant some form of action? If you don't like the law, that's not an excuse not to enforce the law. And so, yes, I actually do agree that the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice should open papers into an antitrust violation against Google and against Amazon. Now, whether or not I like those laws is not relevant in this discussion. I actually generally do. I do think we should have some monopolistic controls. I do believe that with the power that Google has and the one-sidedness of their company and the pattern of behavior that we have seen from their company, and to reinforce that, such as listing the California Republican Party, their ideology as Nazism, what they've done against Prager University, firing their employee James Damore for issuing a memo, it is without a doubt that Google is very, very far to the left. And the amount of population control that they have within their own ranks needs to be examined. And we need to have a question in our society: should a company have that much power over the potential behavioral engineering and societal control that they have? And Amazon, my goodness, Amazon has 47% of online retail sales. Do you know what that's done to the mom-and-pop stores all across this country? You know that Amazon, one could make the argument that they artificially cut their prices just to be able to make other businesses go out of business, which is not legal, by the way. Now, again, I mentioned this. Amazon Web Services is the only profitable arm, if you will, quote-unquote profitable arm of Amazon. All the rest of Amazon loses money. And so let's just do a probe into Amazon. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, their stocks are not going to have a good week this week. And you know what? If that's a consequence of them getting so big and so powerful throughout the years and not having a check against them, then so be it. Now, I believe, as a free marketeer, the best regulation is competition. So let's let other entrepreneurs compete against Google. I want 1,000 people to try to create the next great search engine. I want 10,000 people to try to create the next online retail space. But when you have companies that have that much control and that much power and they don't have that kind of check and balance against them, it is not healthy for a market whatsoever. So this is a pro-market, pro-rule of law stance that I understand that we as conservatives should be very hesitant to use the authority of government and use the absolute monopoly of power that government has. We should be hesitant. However, this is one of those times. This is one of those times that we, in the pursuit of our ideas and the pursuit of our principles, should allow the Department of Justice to enforce the rule of law fairly and equally so we can allow competition and entrepreneurialism to win the day. And one more thought on the antitrust issue. You have leading tech pioneers like Jeremy Stoppelman, the co-founder of Yelp. I use Yelp all the time. He's concluded that startups like his would no longer be successful in today's landscape. Stoppelman, of course, the founder of the great company Yelp. I'm guessing a lot of people on this program use Yelp to rate restaurants. By the way, rate the Charlie Kirk Show. Give us 5 stars. He said himself, quote, "That opportunity has been closed off," referencing the ability to start a new company, "has been closed off by Google and their approach," end quote. So Stoppelman, his opinion matters so much. It makes a lot of sense to me. There's no longer a level playing field for newer, smaller, independent companies. And by the way, if anyone would know, Stoppelman would know. And let's add on to that the European Union, which I don't always agree with, by the way, on a lot of different things. They even levied a $2.7 billion fine against Google, claiming it manipulated search results to suppress competitors. And so you add all these things together, it's time to allow the Department of Justice to enforce the rule of law so that we can allow competition to win the day. All right, so let's dive into a couple questions on this flash episode to start the week off strong. Again, please leave your questions. Give us those 5-star reviews. We're answering straight from it. So I want to answer Jason's question. He only gave me 4 stars, though. Jason only gave me 4 stars on the podcast. That's okay. I'm still going to answer his question. Please give us those 5 stars. He said, quote, Jason said, "We always talk about red states turning blue. Can you predict some blue states that are turning red?" This is a great question. And so I actually think we've seen Donald Trump completely and fundamentally change the electoral map. We've seen states that were traditionally battleground states like Ohio become deep red states. We've seen states like Iowa become deep red states where Republicans are winning all across the board. And we've seen states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania be won by him and become more and more competitive. Now, of course, some of those states kind of went back a little bit to their Democrat roots in the 2018 midterm, such as Wisconsin. Scott Walker should have been reelected. Scott Walker is the most successful, most courageous, most valiant governor of the last 20 years and got no credit for it. Imagine a guy that completely fixes everything in your state. Imagine he comes, let's just use the metaphor of your house. He fixes everything. Your water was leaking, your heat wasn't going right, he fixes the air conditioning, the oven wasn't, he fixes everything. It was a total mess. There was flooding, everything is beautiful. The house is now beautiful. And you kick him out and you don't even thank him for it. That's essentially what happened to Scott Walker in Wisconsin. When he took over Wisconsin, it was almost a 10% unemployment rate. The bond rating was garbage. They couldn't pay for roads. The schools were inadequately funded. Now when he leaves, it's the lowest ever unemployment rate ever. They're creating more jobs than ever before. He has solved the pension crisis. Property taxes were going down. Had a property tax freeze. I mean, Scott Walker, totally amazing. And of course, got zero to no thanks for it. And so I actually do see a couple states, I think, that have a higher likelihood of going in the conservative Republican direction in 2020. And that's because I think the number one issue heading into 2020 is going to be immigration. There is a serious humanitarian crisis going on our southern border. Make no mistake. Even Bernie Sanders tweeted something similar to that in the last couple of days. He said, make no mistake. Let me be perfectly clear. But there is a crisis on the southern. Even he is saying there's a crisis on the southern border. And I think Donald Trump's clear and specific and morally correct position on immigration, such as having national sovereignty, believing in legal immigration and merit-based immigration, is going to win him a lot of favor in states like New Mexico, Arizona, and Nevada. My friends on the ground, the people that I know really well on the ground in New Mexico, they're saying something's changing, that Donald Trump could win New Mexico, and he actually did a lot better in New Mexico than people would have thought. And actually, Democrats did really, really well in New Mexico in 2008, and they've done worse every election since. That's been their watershed, and they've actually been retreating since. New Mexico was actually a really, really tight state back in the 2004 election, George W. Bush versus John Kerry. New Mexico is a state that has, I think, been mislabeled as a deep blue state. Remember, we had Republican Governor Susana Martinez there not too long ago. And as immigration gets so radicalized by Democrats, I think Republicans have an opportunity to have a very common sense, pro-sovereignty, pro-American, pro-merit-based decision immigration stance. And so other states that I think that could be flipped, I think that you're going to have a breaking point. At some point, I think you're going to have a breaking point in some of these states where Democrats have screwed up so terribly, where they've had such unbelievable control. And I'm talking about specifically in the American Northeast. You heard it here first. In the next 10 years, you're going to see a state like Connecticut. You're going to see a state like Rhode Island. You're going to see a state like even Vermont, because Vermont, believe it or not, has a Republican governor. There's your fact of the day that you can go tell someone away. You want to win a Trivial Pursuit. You want to win a bet and say, hey, what party is Vermont's governor? That's right. The home state of Bernie Sanders has a Republican governor. Isn't that amazing? That's a fun fact to walk away with. That actually shows there's so much value to why Massachusetts has a Republican governor right now and why Maryland has a Republican governor right now and Vermont has a Republican governor right now. Because people might want to think they're all into these socialist ideas, but when it comes to their actual politics that are local, the stuff that they can touch and the stuff that they can feel, a common sense Republican leader more times than not will appeal to the hardworking middle class base that determine these elections. So you heard it here first. In a national election, a presidential election, I think that something's going to break. I think a state like Connecticut or Vermont in the next 10 years, I know it's super bold, actually could break. And so George W. Bush won New Mexico in 2004, but it was super thin margins. If I'm not mistaken, it was, a couple hundred votes here or there. We'll actually get the exact numbers on it. To go back to actually what I was saying earlier about New Mexico. But so to answer the question by Jason, who gave us 4 stars, not 5, because all of you guys should give us 5, we'll answer questions. I think that you're going to see huge changes in the American Southwest. And I also think in the Northeast, in the next 10 years, you are going to see that break because the policies in Connecticut, for example, of high taxes, the policies of broken roads and underfunding schools and people we're treating away from there are going to break. And you can see the canary in the coal mine. You can see things happening such as in Massachusetts and Vermont and Maryland, those 3 states that already have Republican governors. The exact count in 2004 was 6,000 votes. George W. Bush won New Mexico by 6,000 votes. That's not very many in 2004, which actually helped him, of course, win re-election against John Kerry. All right, I want to get to Kylie's question here. I'm going to guess Kylie is a girl, but I don't want to assume anyone's gender. So thank you, Kylie, for the question. She gave me 5 stars. So 5 stars is great. Before I get to that, I want to reinforce something earlier that came to my mind. I was thinking of the New Mexico 2000 election of close margins. This is really, really important and gets totally glossed over. So Al Gore won New Mexico 286,783 to George W. Bush's 286,417. Why does this matter? If George Bush would have gotten 500 more votes or 1,000 more votes, Florida would never have mattered. So that's really something to think about, right? Because everyone said, oh, Florida was the most important thing. Well, it wasn't. But there were other states that were super close too. Tennessee was also really close. That George W. Bush won. Why does Tennessee matter? Well, it was Al Gore's home state. So there were a lot of states that were super close. This is an argument for the Electoral College, everybody. How cool is this? That a presidency was decided by super close, razor-thin margins by people that are thousands of miles away from each other. Tennessee, New Mexico, Florida. Isn't that a great argument for the decentralization of power and the brilliance of the Electoral College? So let's now get to Kylie's question. She gave me 5 stars. I hope you do too. And please write these questions. We're going to do this every week. I want to have the interaction. I want to dive deep. Ask me the tough questions. She says, what do you think about tolls? Oh, I'm an expert in tolls. Why am I an expert in tolls? I live in Chicago. You know, I'm always struck, you know, our founding at Turning Point USA, when we used to do our staff trainings at Turning Point USA, we used to drive around, you know, we might be going to a training, might be going to a conference center, might be going to a restaurant. And I would have people from other states, specifically, let me think what state it was where they had never seen tolls before. I think it was North Dakota or something. Why do you have to keep on paying $6 every time you go through a toll? And in Chicago, you could easily spend $15, $20 a day just driving around doing your business. And so, look, inherently, I hate giving my money to government. But if I was given a choice, hey, Charlie, would you rather pay more in tolls, essentially more in a user tax, and less on income tax, which would you prefer? And I would rather pay more in user tax. I would rather pay more on tolls. Now, why is that? Because if I'm using something, I'm okay with participating and paying for it. Like, I think a government that is accountable to how many people that are actually using it is much better than just an endless vacuum going into places where there's no accountability. So people who drive more, I think, should have to pay more for the tolls, or people that really never drive at all should not have to pay for the tolls. Now, some would make the argument, and there is some merit to this argument, that it's regressive, that people with less money, it's a bigger burden on them because they don't have as much money to spend. And there is some merit to that argument. I understand that. And so that's when you start to get into how people will change their behavioral patterns. And that's what you've seen in New York, for example. A lot of people in middle class and lower middle class have forfeited actually owning cars altogether. You watch the old Seinfeld episodes. Jerry Seinfeld used to own a car, and George Costanza used to own a car. And there used to be all these hilarious jokes over, can I use your car? Can I borrow it? I don't want to pay for parking. And they have these hilarious episodes about just a parking spot. And now over the last 20 years, since, of course, 25 years since Seinfeld has stopped, you've seen less and less people own cars and more people go to public transportation because it's so expensive to have a car in New York. First of all, gas is like $6 a gallon. Second of all, just getting in and out of Manhattan could be as much as $15. I think they want to raise it to get into Manhattan to be even more. And so look, I don't like giving my money to government. I think tolls can be really annoying. But if I had a trade-off, I would rather have some form of mechanism that you pay as you go. That if you were to, the more you drive, the more you pay, the more you use a service, the more you pay for it. Of course, that sounds a lot better as it said that actually in practice, but that's the type of usage fee that I would much prefer. Well, this has been a lot of fun, everybody. This is a flash episode of the Charlie Kirk Show. We'll be back Wednesday. Please give us those 5 stars. Go to tpusa.com. If you want to get involved, please do that. If you want to donate to us, that's amazing. Go to charliekirk.com. We love the support. Thank you to our listeners. See you in a couple days on Wednesday. Or for those of you listening to this podcast, as it's a timeless podcast, many, many years in the future, what I said today will hopefully always be true because this show is rooted in principle, rooted in timeless ideas and analysis of the facts. Thanks so much for listening. Give us those 5 stars. We'll be back soon.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.